Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome, everybody. I'm Allison Stewart. The film Close was inspired by the true story of one of the first female bodyguards in the UK. Close was written and directed by Vicky Jewson, and the cast is led by Noomi Rapace, the actress who tackled the lead role in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The film is action-packed and suspenseful and full of twists and turns, which we will not give away. Close will be released on Netflix on January 18th, and Noomi and Vicky are in studio. Hi, ladies.
Hi. Hello.
So this is based on the real-life bodyguard. Her name is Jackie Davis, right?
Yes.
How would you describe Jackie and the work she did?
She is a very inspiring woman. She's a tough lady. She started off in the police and then hit a glass ceiling in the 80s because she felt like there was nowhere for her to progress in her career as a woman. So she joined the circuit, which is the sort of collaborative of close protection officers across the world. And she was able to work in counterterrorism, hostage rescue. She saved people from Russian assassins. Her life is very fascinating, as well as VIP protection work. She does this huge range of other deadly tasks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of curious, what does she look like? If you walked past her on the street, would you think that's someone
who could
take out?
She's tall, quite skinny. You can see in her eyes and in her face that she's seen a lot of dark stuff. You can see that life, you know, she, I mean, the people she met and situations she's been in, it kind of, you can just feel that she doesn't have, she probably started off more positive in life and then she's seen so much and you can see in her, and she's like, she's straight to the point. No
like
time
that
for small talk. She's from a different world.
Yeah, yeah. It took us a long time to build that trust for her to kind of let her guard down with
totally
us and trust us so that she could be more personal with us.
Yeah, because that's one of the rules also in her profession, to never be private, to never talk about yourself and to never be emotional about anything. So she kind of learned to shut herself down, I think, and to not be emotional.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
As the both of you were researching this project, what kind of things did you want to know and did you think you needed to know to make this authentic?
I mean, everything from, you know, how do you sleep? Like, you know, what do you do first thing in the morning? How do you approach a room? What's the first thing you do when you get a new principal, a person to protect? I mean, everything from basic small things and to big, like emotional things. Like, are you scared? What happens if you know, do you ever feel, do you have regrets? I mean, stuff like that. So I wanted to dig as deep down in her soul and in her life as I possibly could.
We really wanted to make it authentic. We wanted her whole world to be able to watch the film and believe that it was true to her life. I mean, even to the detail where we were having coffee with her one day and we were looking at her hands and she had fingernails, long fingernails, like very glamorous ones on her left hand, and on her right they were short and stubby, more like my fingernails. And we asked why, and she said, oh, that's my gun hand. So we just, like, details like that were just
that's
amazing.
That's an amazing detail.
Yeah.
And obviously it's good. I mean, as a director, you are someone who has to observe a lot. You have to take in those kind of small interactions that can have much bigger meaning. Mm.
Exactly. It's all about sewing in those details and getting that authenticity into the film, which was why it was such a real privilege to work with her.
For people, I won't give too much away. She is assigned, her principal is a spoiled heiress. Mm. Who is lost in herself in a way. She's lost in her ego, but also she's a lost kid.
Mm. She's very isolated.
Yeah, and there's this great scene where they're going to her home where she's supposed to be, and she says, welcome to my prison, because it is such a compound and so remote and so locked down. Mm. Tell us a little bit about the woman who plays that part, and then, Noomi, I want you to talk to me a little about the chemistry between the two of you.
Mm. So that's played by Sophie Nellessy. And obviously, Noomi came on board the project before Sophie. And it was really important that we found someone that the chemistry would work with, because the whole movie is about these two women and their relationship. And Sophie was not afraid to play the role in an unlikable way at the beginning, because she's a bit of a brat to start with. And Sophie embraced that and was able to do it with a bit of humor, because her character arc is very much an extreme coming of age story. Mm. And it's funny because Sam's completely mirrors her sort of start point. Sam is very isolated as well. She's in a prison of her own making. So I love the fact that these two women start off thinking they're complete opposites, but actually they are both sharing the same loneliness and isolation. And Zoe is the one that kind of like keeps hammering through Sam's defences to find out what's really, well, what she's running from and what ends up ultimately driving her.
And Sam is the bodyguard, just for our listeners. Yes. When you and Zoe are working together, when Sam and Zoe are working together, what do you think their relationship is at the beginning and how does it evolve?
In the beginning, it's a case that Sam, my character, doesn't want to take. She finds it boring. I mean, she's also an addict to kind of the fire, I think, to be on the front line. And this feels like a very easy job, I think, you know, to this rich, spoiled girl. You know, in the beginning, you see a scene when I'm looking her up and I'm looking at her Facebook account and I'm like, oh my days, this is going to be, this is not going to be fun. And also, I think that Sam doesn't really, she's working class. She's been working really hard. She left. She has a like heavy history behind her. And she doesn't like, you know, kind of spoiled and girly girls as well. I think she's so they're quite opposite. And then she takes on this case anyway. And also that kind of triggers something in her. And it's also I'm not going to spoil anything, but she has a secret from her past that I think that Zoe just like hits right into that nerve, which makes it even more complicated for her. And then slowly throughout this journey, I mean, she breaks the golden rule. She becomes emotional. She starts caring about this girl for real. And from that point and onwards, it's a shift in her and she's battling her own demons, but also slowly starting to feel and to open up things that's been buried for a long time.
My guests are Naomi Rapace and Vicky Juice, and we're talking about the film Close. So in this New York Times article, I know probably people quoted it to you, but this is an amazing thing you say about how you train very differently, Naomi, for every role. There's a different kind of physicality you need. So in this, you're stabbing people, you are shooting people, you are jumping out of windows, you're full on.
Yeah.
Tell me about training for this.
Yeah, it was intense. The stunt coordinator, Julian Spencer, was amazing, but also kind of has his own methods. The first time I met him, we were out in the Pinewood Studios, it was an empty big room, and he said, there's two guys waiting outside, they're going to come in and they're going to attack you. What would you do? What are you going to do? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, they're gonna come in now, so be ready. he's like, I don't want it to be perfect. I don't want this film to look, you know, Hollywoodish and like, you know, perfect, beautiful, sexy stunts and fight scenes that are like choreographed. I want it to be gritty, raw, real. So I'm gonna base it from out of how you move and your body language and how you would defend yourself. So I was like, okay, embrace yourself for impact. But it was very intense. It was hard. It was weapon training. I was also training with a Circuit, the organization for bodyguards, for and spending time with Jackie. So it was like one internal kind of more psychological process to understand the character, but a lot of physical things. Just to walk with the principal, just to, like how do you step into a car, like how do you step into a room, elevator, to read rooms, to read possible threats. So it's a whole new, I mean, it's a universe that I had to like start to, you know, I'm peeked into, and it's quite fascinating.
For you as a director, what is that like to have to figure out sort of the arc of a fight?
Yeah, well, right? I was always very strong going into this movie that I wanted to bring a kind of fresher, rawer, more real action for women in film. And Noomi and I completely gelled on that the first time we met, because I often think when you see women in action, they've kind of got superhero strength or they're wearing stiletto heels. And I wanted to bring that sort of rawness to the fights. So a big scene in cinema for me is True Romance, the fight between Patricia Arquette and James Gandolfini, and she's fighting from a place of survivalism and there's a lot of suspense there, and she fails and she perseveres, and I think because of that we really invest in that action as it's happening. And for me as a director, I think successful action is all about the tension and the build-up and connecting to the character. So we wanted to bring all of that into the fights. So we did a lot of previs, but I wanted them to be claustrophobic, intense, and feel very brutal. And the wonderful thing about working with someone like Noomi is she brings that character into that fight scene. So there's no sense that there's any choreography going on. It feels very spontaneous and in the moment, and you feel very connected to her character, which I think gets you invested in it in a very different way.
And you also get the sense that she's in pain. In so many fight scenes, people pop back up. But you, when you take it, you're like, oh, that hurts. Yeah. And that looks like it hurts. Yeah. And it looks like it's continuing to hurt.
It does. Yeah. And that was So actually, one of the first things Vicky said, and I totally fell in love with her. From that moment, I was like, lost. I'm having. She was like, I want the cuts and the hits to show and to stay on her face throughout the movie. Because every movie, I'm fighting for this. I'm fighting for real. I want it to be credible. I don't want to look pretty. I mean, I want to look the part, and whatever she's going through, I want to go through. So I think we share very much a view on things, and we kind of partnered up and we became partners straight away. Exactly. Normally I'm battling. Normally I'm trying to like prove my point into the bitter end, but yeah.
We were on the battlefield together, yeah. Which felt great.
But it was heavy. I mean, it was really hard. I didn't have a stunt double. I did everything. So, I mean, normally you would have a stunt person that kind of does, you know, running up a hill or driving a car when it's from like from a distance. But I basically did everything.
She did. So,
yeah. And how much physical therapy did you need the following few weeks?
Well,
a lot. Let's just say a lot.
I would say so. My guests are Noomi Rapaz and Vicky Juice. And Vicky has co-written and directed this film, Close. And Noomi is starring in it. It's coming out on Netflix on January 18th. So this film definitely passes the Bechdel test. We know what that is, right? And for people who aren't listening, it's got to have women in two scenes,
uh-huh.
Women who talk to each other, and they don't talk about men.
Oh my God, I love this.
Have you ever heard this before?
No.
Yes, it's this test for film about...
Oh, fantastic.
Kind of... And when you start to look at movies and TV shows, you're like, wow, a lot of... Can't
you know
pass
what's
that
interesting
test.
As yeah. well? Jackie Davis, when she read the script, in an early draft, there was a sex scene. And then we took it out. And then she read the new draft, and she was like, thank you. I love this now. Now it's real.
Yeah, right.
She's like, in my world, it wouldn't be a sex scene. And she's like, and now all my colleagues in the Middle Eastern countries can watch it.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And she said all these Hollywood films, it's always like, you know, the women are supposed to be badass and then they're like having sex like straight away with their like CIA agents
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, I mean, the number of scripts I get sent that are like that. They like establish a tough woman, but within the end of page one, she's already having sex. And you're like, oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, yeah. As we do, you know, we are sexy and hot and we fight.
Someone's dream. Some guy writing a dream.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of writing it, I mean, did you think about I'm going to write a feminist part, or is it just this is who this person is, this is his character, and I'm going to go find the right actress?
For me, as a director, I always wanted to make films that feature strong, kind of layered, complex female protagonists in action genre or genre movies. So when I was growing up, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and all the movies that were the action movies all obviously starred men. And I associated with those characters, and I was a bit of a tomboy. So when I started making movies, I was like, well, I want to see a woman in those roles. So for me, it really kind of came from that place that I was writing something that I wanted to see. I didn't necessarily have like a feminist agenda. It's just the story that I wanted to tell, really.
As far as the roles that you get, do you get roles that are like this? Do these scripts come along often, or is this a rare thing?
No, I feel pretty blessed. I think people by now as well know that I don't really want to play the cute or the sexy, you know, sidekick. But sometimes, like what happened to Monday, this movie I did, where I play seven sisters, it was seven brothers to start with. So when they sent it to me, the director sent it to me, it was seven brothers. He's like, I can only see you. And if you want to do it with me, we are going to change it to seven sisters. So that happened a few times.
That's interesting. It's great.
Yeah, I read a script and they say, if you want to do it, we're going to change it into a woman. But this one was written for a woman. It was, and I think what's very unique about Vicky is that she you're fierce and you have like you fight really hard for what you want and you're very passionate, but you're also very open-minded and you're constantly like searching and exploring, and it's not about like, oh, girl power, we hate men, because that for me is like, oh, well, whatever,
that's as boring as the opposite.
Yeah, because right? That's the same, you know. Yeah. So it's about creating something interesting but also diving into yourself and like exploring yourself. And I was also a bit of a tomboy, so we have that in common. And I always identified, I watched all these, I lived through films, like I survived watching films from a remote farm, you know, in the countryside in Sweden. But all my heroes were men. So for me now, when young girls come up to me and they like my films and they like what I do, that makes me so, like, really, really happy and honored.
Where was this filmed?
We shot it in the UK and then in Morocco. So we were in Morocco for 4 weeks, which was fantastic, from Casablanca up into the Atlas Mountains.
So what's the greatest thing about shooting Morocco, and then the biggest challenge of shooting Morocco?
I think the greatest thing is the access. We worked with a wonderful company called K-Films. They do the Bond movies, so they're very experienced. And you can do things I don't think you'd be able to do in the UK, like the helicopters and the access to the army and all those action elements and the extras. You can get a lot of production value on the screen.
And everything is beautiful, to be
honest.
And
everything is beautiful, yeah.
It's like a patchwork of colors. It's just very rich and very alive, but also slightly dangerous. I mean, you can feel, you can smell it. It's not really safe.
It's an extreme place.
Yeah,
I think that's the challenge.
And it's very cinematic. It's
there.
Very cinematic.
Exactly.
But it was extremely hot. We had very long days. I remember one day we were shooting in kind of a rough neighborhood in Casablanca, and it was just this
everyone
mess.
Was sick.
Everyone was sick. Yeah. It was people everywhere, chaos, dogs, kids, you know. It's just
there was a man going
around,
yeah, with like a fish trolley, and there was just blood behind him because all the fish had been gutted. It was just dripping on the floor, you know.
Yeah,
you do get those extreme
smell.
Contrast and the smell. Yeah.
So,
and a lot of our crew were quite poorly, so that was a bit of a challenge. We'd be losing crew members like flies.
Yeah, it was always someone.
There was always
up.
Someone rushing to the
to
the pot.
Yeah, it was tough.
The glamorous life of making movies, right?
Exactly.
So, Vicky, you got your start pretty young. You were 21, is that right, when you made your first film?
So I was 18 when I wrote it. I've been making movies my whole life. So since I was about 6 years old, I always had a camera in my hands.
I've heard stories from your sister that you her sister's an actress. That she was directing her sister from very early age.
I had the perfect person. As my teammate.
Kidding me.
I was always getting her to like drown in the river or get blown up by a firework or something. But yeah, every summer holiday, all my mates would come over and we'd make a movie. So when I was 18, I just thought, I had two places to go study English at university, but I just wanted to make another movie. And that kind of snowballed and became my first feature film. I ended up raising the money myself, and I haven't really looked back.
We all grow over the course of our careers and things we want to do, but is there something that's just still very much you and your style and your ethos from back when you were 18 to the movies you make now? Is there something that's just kind of stayed the same in the work that you do? Not same in the boring way, but that's intrinsically you.
That's a good thing, yeah, because you learn so much every time you make a movie. Actually, you feel like you're constantly kind of coming out of the I don't know, like where a moth makes its little home, and then you're breaking away and leaving it behind. But I think I like to have an honesty and a rawness in what I do. And I feel like that probably comes across in my films, particularly in my last film as well, Born of War. There's a sort of rawness to the characters. And I think I'm an actor's director, and I love working with wonderfully talented people like Noomi. And I think that's probably something that's remained consistent.
But you're also interested in the real world. It feels like, I mean, I love... I'm not madly in love with action films, but I love violent dramas, you know. But if the heart is something real, that you can feel like, you know, there's a real person in this. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that I've seen throughout your work, that it's always based from something. It comes out of something very real and very authentic.
Yeah, something that I can feel connected
to.
I think
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Even though you love action.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people in our industry would kind of see action as something else. Your action is slightly different, I think.
More intimate, maybe.
Yeah.
Noomi, same question for you. You started in stage as a kid, and then you've moved on and progressed in your career. But is there something that's still very authentically you and in the choices you make?
Wow. Well, I always try to be honest. I made a decision very early on to never let my vanity and my fears block me or stand in the way between me and the character and my work. And that's something I'm constantly battling. Mm-hmm. But I think that's my biggest promise to myself, to always try to be 100%. and do everything that I possibly can to make it as real as possible.
I think that's what really drew me to Noomi as well before I met her. Was in all her work, there is this emotional honesty and integrity that I just was like a moth to a flame, because I just find that fascinating to watch. And it's a real joy to work with someone that brings that.
Did you fly into the fire?
I totally did. I'd do it again.
Before I let you go, you've been attached to this Maria Callas project.
Yeah,
for a while.
I haven't shot it yet.
Well, Glenn Close was attached to the wife for 14 years.
Yeah,
so it,
yeah.
But it, what? Any update?
The director is Nikki Caro is shooting Mulan, this big Disney film in New Zealand. So she's down there, probably creating something magical. But I think we're gonna revisit the whole thing when she's done. And it's hard when it's two schedules. Like, I mean, I've been on an insane schedule and she's working all the time too. But it is the intention to make it, to bring life to it.
Fingers crossed. It'll happen. Noomi Rapace and Vicky Jusin. The name of the film is Close. It's out on Netflix this Friday, January 18th. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having us.
Coming up next, Danish actor Mads Mikkelsen, who has two intense movies coming forth, Arctic and Polar. We'll catch up with Mads next. This is All of It. Stay with us. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. In the next couple of weeks, you'll be able to see Danish actor Mads Mikkelsen in a tense film in which his protagonist opts out of a relative comfort and safety to save the life of an imperiled woman he barely knows. In fact, you'll be able to see Mads in two movies like that, both with frosty names. One's called Polar, the other is Arctic, but that's as far as the similarities go. On January 25th, Netflix will drop the wild noir action movie Polar, directed by Jonas Åkerlund and based on a graphic novel of the same name. Mikkelsen plays an assassin whose retirement is, shall we say, postponed? Postponed. Yep. And a week later, on February 1st, Arctic will open in select theaters. The film premiered at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Mads, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Three in that chair real fast.
Yeah.
So on the surface, as I mentioned, these movies are about a man who goes out of his way to try to save a woman's life who he barely knows. So I'm curious, what order did these films come to you? Which one did you do first?
I did Arctic first, and then back to back I did Polar. So that was a few months in freezing my weight off. Yeah.
And other things off too, I'm sure.
Yep.
So did one of them, did Arctic, since you did that first, man, plane crash, he decides to try to save the woman who was in a helicopter that was trying to save him. Did that role at all inform Polar, or are they just separate things in your mind when you have two projects like that back to back?
They're completely different animals. I mean, Arctic is a survival drama, and Polar is, as we talked about, is based on a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And it's, when I say graphic, I mean really graphic. And so they're completely different animals.
When I actually saw the trailer to Arctic before you were going to be on the show. I was going to see Destroyer, Nicole Kidman's movie. And it's one of those movies that you think about, what if I were in this situation?
Yeah.
It's almost scarier to me than a horror movie in some ways, because your character is just alone in the Arctic, in the cold. Where was it filmed?
It was filmed in Iceland, so there was actually people somewhere on the island. Yeah, we were lucky in that sense. It's a survival story. It was a very beautiful read when the script came my way. It was one of these things where you're a little afraid that they will fall into the traps of going down memory lane or having flashbacks, but they never did that. It was just there was a purity, there was a refinedness to it that I really fell in love with.
There isn't that much dialogue. So much of what your character is going through is internal. Mm. When you read that as an actor, what kind of challenges does that pose for you? And then how do you work through that?
Reading it, the challenges are not that big. You just go, oh, easy. It's a walk in the park. I don't have to remember my lines, right? But once you're there, that's when the traps arrive. You know, you might fall into the trap of trying to entertain because you're getting a little bored with yourself. Mm-hmm. You're all by yourself and you're not talking. And so producing a little extra just to entertain is a risky thing. You really have to keep an eye on not doing that.
Because it will become too big for
the
story?
Yeah, for this kind of film. Yeah. I mean, I don't mind producing for other kind of films, but there's a certain honesty in this film. It's a film about the enormous difference between surviving and being alive, which is two very, very different things. And we just had to stick to that and be honest with that and not try to entertain too much. But hopefully it's still entertaining, though.
We meet, it's Overgaard, we meet him in a moment, just in this moment. You don't know his backstory. You don't know why he was in this plane. You don't know why the plane crashed, really. You almost know more about the woman he's trying to save because you take a picture. There's a photo of her and her with her family. Did you make a backstory yourself, you and the director, for him?
I made one, and the director, I'm sure, made a different one. It's not crucial for the story, but it was crucial for me to have an idea where he came from. But as you said, that we know more about the woman, and that little photo that she carries around becomes enormously important to my character. So obviously we can guess that he's probably got someone back home as well.
Why do you think, when you were creating this character, why does your character decide to go to such lengths to save this woman who he doesn't know, doesn't really know anything about, and who, by trying to save her, really puts his life in peril?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, who saves who, right? I mean, obviously, when we meet him, he is a survivor. That's all he is. And when she lands in his film and in his world, all of a sudden he becomes alive again. And so in many ways, she's the one rescuing him from being this comfortable numb who is basically not moving out of the spot. He's just there. He might be able to sit there for 20 years, 6 years, we don't know. But the interaction with another human being makes him human.
So the idea is that he, because we meet him and he's figured out how to fish and he's created sort of a place to live.
He's got a system, it works for him. And he's crossing his fingers and he's doing his little SOS things, but he's kind of lost hope, all hope.
And there is that moment, I don't want to give too much away, but there are moments when you see that he thinks maybe I'll have a real life again.
Yeah.
Maybe there are flashes of it, and almost like he doesn't want to entertain that. It might be too painful to entertain that he might survive, go beyond survival.
Absolutely. I mean, through her, there is life, even though she's half dead throughout the whole film. This is the representation of life, what he used to have. And I mean, on the surface, it's a survival film, but on a deeper level, it's obviously, kick open your basement, go out there, embrace world, embrace other people, and that's what makes you human.
You mentioned this at the top, how cold it was. Mm. Tell me about your shooting schedule, the shooting days, and what that was like.
Well, the schedule is actually, we're nominated to shoot for 30 days, and we had to drop that down to 19 days because due to the weather conditions, we had situations, we opened the car doors and they broke off and they disappeared down the valley, gone with the wind.
For real? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we had to cancel one of those days, and it was a lot of challenges like that. And so the days became longer and longer. We had 19 of them, so 16 hours shooting days, carrying around with a half-dead woman.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when the film wrapped and you sat down, you were home and having a cocktail, nice warm place, what do you take away from that experience?
I didn't sit down.
You didn't? You just went straight to work?
I went straight to Poland, right, which is another brutal experience.
And well, so, thank you for that segue.
Yeah. So I didn't really have that break. But I took a lot away when everything was done and I wrapped both films. I took a lot away from Arctic. It was one of those films that grew on us as well. We knew what it was about, but it became clearer and clearer that finding the humanity in a survival film was of the essence of what we wanted to talk about in this film.
My guest is Mads Mikkelsen. His film is Arctic. It will be in theaters on February 1st. So let's talk about Polar now.
Polar.
Tell me if the internet's telling the truth. You love graphic novels?
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm a huge collector, actually. I think I've been collecting since I was a kid. And then when I made my first money, I started buying stuff, first edition stuff, and I've been collecting until, let's say, 15 years ago. It just became too crazy, too much I wanted to own, and I gave up on it.
What draws you to them?
Pardon the pun.
Well, I think it was maybe it was his escape from the boring reality, and you just dived into a universe that was right in front of you. You could be any of these characters as long as you close your eyes and imagine something. So I've always been a huge fan of that work.
So your character is Black Kaiser in this
Black
film.
Black Kaiser, Duncan Whistler.
And he's sort of at peace at first. We meet him. He's about to retire. Mm. He's okay with that.
Not so much.
Not so much? You don't think so?
Well, I mean, on the surface. We see the situation where people can't wait to be retired. But he's really he's not that eager. I mean, he doesn't know what's on the other side. This is all he's been doing his entire life. So he's manning up, and well, retirement is coming, but he's not fancying it too much.
Well, the doctor warns him, says, you know, this is the most difficult time.
Exactly.
After a man retires.
Right.
Things can happen to him, and things start to happen to him. When you talk to the director, did you understand it was going to be so stylized? This is a very, it's so gonzo. It's sort of crazy. There's lots of graphics. It's very saturated in terms of colors. Did you know all that going in? And well, let me ask you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the first thing I saw was the graphic novels, and there was a pitch. Later on, there was a script, the first edition of the script, but it was all based on these novels. And as you said, they're graphic, but they're also crazy in the sense that you have some characters like that are 10 times bigger than another character, which is obviously very difficult to put on the screen. So we had to come up with other ways to give them those edges so the characters would feel like that. I knew that we were entering a world that was not a superhero world, but it was definitely having some edges that you wouldn't see in a normal action film.
So how does that, what impact does that have on the choices you make as an actor when you know you're going to be in this super styly production?
Well, it does have an impact that you will let go of some of your barriers, and like, I can wear that. Yes, I can, you know, because this is a different world. Having said that, I mean, there are kind of two parallel stories here. There's a Duncan Whistler story, the Black Kaiser story, which is a kind of a low-key, slow-tempoed, awkward meeting between him and a young woman. Some of it is quite amusing and sweet and funny. And then you have this high-speed, crazy graphic novel that's chasing him down. And eventually they're going to collapse those two stories. And so we had two different little films going parallel and then clashing later on.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because I think that's what I was alluding to, his sort of composure that he has with this young woman, with this encounter with this young woman, which we find out what that really means later on. Why do you think graphic novels are good for making movies? Why do you think they're good? Or don't you?
I do think they are, but they're also very tricky because you can get away with stuff in a graphic novel you can't put on the screen. It's just impossible, unless obviously you go and animate it. I think it's just that the stories are very essential. You know, they're very essential. I mean, you can also call them very black and white, but I think there's more to it than that. It's some basic instinct in some of these graphic novels that we can all relate to. It's not so muddy. This is him. This is her. This is what they want. So I think there's an identity in there.
It's also there. There's a certain amount of mythology.
Absolutely.
Too.
Yeah, this Shakespearean all the way, right? They become, the second you open the book, the graphic novel, you can see he's a myth. He's a legend already. The way they bring him to life. That's a lot of weight on our shoulders, of course, but there is something to the graphic novel. They can get away with anything. The big trick for us is how to bring it to life.
What kind of training did you have to go through?
Well, we did a lot of stunt rehearsals, of course, and I had to build up, so I was able to do that. I'm an ex-gymnast and ex-dancer, so some of it was coming easy and some was not. But we didn't want him to be, obviously, a bodybuilder. We didn't want him to spend 8 hours a day in the gym. But we wanted him to be heavy, strong, and lethal, but also a little tired. that part came easy.
My guess is Mads Mikkelsen. We're talking about his two films, which are coming out within a week of one another. One is called Arctic. That's February 1st in select theaters. And Polar, January 25th on Netflix. So it's interesting that you did these back-to-back because Polar is an ensemble piece, and Arctic, it's just you. What was that?
And one more person. A vital, vital person.
Yes,
that was the best part of the whole film for me when she entered the film.
Yes.
Yeah.
But having to be by yourself, ish, in Arctic, and then to be in this big ensemble. Tell me about the benefits of each and the challenges of each.
I think that the character of Duncan Whistler, the Black Kaiser, excuse me, he's a loner as well in many ways. He's not a super highly skilled social person, let's put it that way. I mean, he makes an effort to teach some kids stuff, it's quite funny, but it's not really the way you should behave as a teacher. So he's awkward.
Oh, that scene is funny.
He's an awkward guy.
Yeah.
So, but for an actor, obviously, we're bouncing off each other when we have colleagues around us. We're doing thumbs up, thumbs down on each other. It's like, let's go that way. We get inspired, right? But if you're all by yourself, there is no such thing. You just have to follow your instinct and your in this case, wonderful director as well. But it's a lonely journey. Even though my character is a lonely wolf in as Black Kaiser, I still have my colleagues to bounce off.
So this idea of the collaboration, that's the exciting part. Do you have to depend on the director more when you're on your own in something like Arctic than when in Polar?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you said it was a trick question. Right?
A little bit.
I have to depend on them in both situations, right? Obviously, the director's eyes in Polar, he's got eyes on maybe 10 actors in one scene. And he's only got his eyes on me in Arctic, right? So it's vulnerable, and it's also a simple task maybe for him. we always rely on he's the eyes, or she is the eyes. We can feel as good as we want to. It might not work still. Somebody has to look at it, right?
So I'm curious, after all this, you're going on the press tour for all these two big projects. What's next? What do we add to this?
Yeah, well, I'm having a great and wonderful break right now.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Promoting these films. And I'm just, it's an interesting thing. We left them 9 months ago, a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. And now they come back and I start freezing again just talking about it. But that's the journey of an actor. You know, we do something and a year later you talk about it. So next for me, I'm going back home to Denmark and shoot a Danish film with a director I've worked with before called Thomas Vinterberg.
Is there any project you're itching to do that's just it's going to happen, you don't know when it's going to happen, but you want it to happen?
No, I mean the lucky situation for us, it comes our way, and if we like it and if we're offered it, and then it becomes our new dream project, but we are luckily unaware of its existence before it happens, right? So I don't have a little Hamlet in me. I'm not like the world's Tsushima Hamlet. I don't have that in me. Every dream project is the next one, the one I jump on board, and then it becomes my dream project for the next year.
It sounds sort of mystical that you think the right projects find you.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, right? This is the fairness or the unfairness of life. But I've been very lucky. People have seen me through different eyes, and I've been offered very, very different things. I think it's interesting to make everything a stepping stone worthwhile, being your dream, as opposed to just be stepping stones towards a goal you might never reach. Just make every project your dream project.
Mads Mikkelsen, he's starring in the film Polar on Netflix on January 25th, and Arctic opens on February 1st. Mads, thank you so much for being with us. Really loved having you.
Absolutely, I love being here.
When we come back, the actor Amar Hajj Ahmad, who plays one of the leads in the critically acclaimed dramatic play The Jungle, running now at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. More after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It from WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The critically acclaimed drama The Jungle has been extended at St. Anne's Warehouse until January 27th. The Jungle refers to a migrant camp in Calais, France. Thousands of refugees from the Middle East and Africa built an ad hoc city from a landfill where they hoped to find safe passage ultimately to the UK. The camp gained global attention when French authorities started evictions. During The Jungle's existence, two young theater guys, Brits named Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson, set up a makeshift theater at The Jungle for people to, they could express themselves, have something to occupy their time, something to give them an outlet, a creative outlet. The Joes, as they came to be known, were inspired by all of this to write a play. Directed by Stephen Daldry and Justin Martin. Joining us in the studio is actor Amar Hajj Ahmad, who plays Safi, the narrator in the jungle. Amar, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much for having me.
So for people who maybe don't remember what the jungle and what Calais was like, can you describe it a little bit? You're probably better than I can.
Yeah, the real jungle.
The real Calais, yeah.
Yeah. There was a moment where the movement from lots of refugees from Syria, some parts of Africa, Egypt, Libya, they chose different routes to get to Europe. And some of them went from the route of Turkey and then walking through countries like Serbia until they got to Turkey, Greece, Serbia, until they got to Germany. And some people from Turkey, they took boats to Greece. But then there was another journey, which is going from Libya or Egypt straight to Italy. From both routes, people went through France and they wanted to get to Britain. And the closest city there was Calais, from which you can just see Dover and the White Cliffs of Dover.
Cliffs of Dover, yes.
Yeah. You can. It's 22 miles. It's not far between Calais and Dover. So people thought it's in a way the best place to get to this dream island, the UK, from France, either by jumping on lorries, which you call it here, trucks, mm-hmm. That they go through the Eurostar tunnel. You know, there is a tunnel. Or to just buy boats.
And the dream
ferries.
Was to get to the UK.
Absolutely.
But it was a dream in many ways because it was so difficult to do. People sometimes smuggled by people with nefarious.
Yeah, absolutely. And every, you know, we'd call them a try. I'm going to try. Mm-hmm. Tonight I'm going to try. And then when this try doesn't work, they'll stay in the camp. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't just stay in tents, so they start to settle, right?
Yeah.
Like anywhere in the world. And that's how the jungle was created. Until at one point, the French authorities wanted to get rid of it. So
that is how the play opens with mm-hmm. the bulldozing of the encampment so that people can get it and the audience get a sense of what happened. Mm. We actually have a little bit of audio from New York Times 360 video of the play. Let's play a little bit of the opening scene from the jungle.
They are wearing body armor! Now this dehumanizes them! They have tear gas! Now when they shoot, you need to cover your faces! But don't wear gas masks, because the police consider them to be weapons! Now, if you're exposed, wash it off with milk or coke, not water! It's our job to rehumanize the situation!
Who does it?
They can't end like this!
So that's that very difficult opening scene. Now, the character you play, Safi, he is the narrator. Mm. As an actor, what do you see his job? And what do you see your job is?
Well, it's to make sense.
Don't make sense of everything? Yeah.
Well, he tries to make sense in a way, because as you said, this is the opening scene of the play. And without spoiling what happens, it's just it's meant to be the opening scene. It is meant to be confusing. Mm-hmm. For us all to say what's going on. And this is what happened when the camp was demolished, that people said, it was bizarre. It was like inexplicable how you just see these makeshift shacks burning and people running. So Safi comes and says, well, I'm going to tell you what happened. And then we go back to the beginning. And yes, he tries to make sense. And he says at one point in his opening speech, he says, I do not pretend we did not make mistakes. And many more will be made in the telling of this story, I am sure. And then And then there is a moment, again, I don't want, yes, I am the narrator, but I'm, Safi is one of the elders in the camp. Mm-hmm. And there are moments where the narrator meets himself as a character. And that is a bit complex to those who watched or will watch The Jungle.
Is he based on anyone, a real person?
So all the characters, they are based on, like, maybe just tiny objective of one, of a real person. But in the course of working and workshopping the written drafts by Joe and Joe in the workshop room, we cooked slowly these characters. Mm-hmm. So some people would say, oh, it's like a documentary. It's not. It's a drama based on some real characters. Not Safi, though, just to point this out.
Okay. My guest is Amar Hajj Ahmad. He is appearing in The Jungle at St. Anne's Warehouse. It's interesting, you know, everybody who's been to St. Anne's, as a member of the audience, you are in the play. You're sort of in the play. You can reach out and touch actors. And sometimes people cry during this performance. Yeah. How does that affect you when you are there and somebody is crying at what's happening?
It's heartbreaking, to be honest. But, you know, like, there is this thought maybe about actors that if you make audience cry or if you make them, that you feel that you're doing a great job. Maybe. And just to point something out, people not only cry, they laugh loudly. It's like joy. They clap, they dance, and then there are moments where they cry. It is heartbreaking, and it's really hard to deal with from the actor, because if you see someone crying, either you cry as well or you just try to restrain. Mm-hmm. And the job of the actor is to restrain. And it is a very delicate moment, because it's a very sensitive and delicate story, and there is so much responsibility conveying and delivering it. So when people cry engaging with this story, there must be care at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that is the genius of Stephen Daldry and Justin Martin. There is always this, Stephen always talks about kindness and to be kind to the audience and each other. And that is what makes it, yes, hard to talk and look in the eyes of the audience when they are crying, but at the same time, they know that. And maybe my job as a narrator, at one point, when I break this and come back to the audience, some people will say, oh, thank you, I feel safe now.
Yeah.
And that is the job, so, you know.
That's the job of art.
Absolutely. It's, you know, I read this at one point, which is incredible, says that art disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. And in The Jungle, this what happens. Like, from a moment of people being completely disturbed, a breeze of, like, gentleness or fun or a joke or a stroke, because we come close to the audience, we talk to them. It's incredible. I can't stop talking about it if you ask me about the impact of, but yeah.
One of the things that's interesting, many things are interesting, but that some of the cast members were having trouble getting into the United States.
Yeah.
Because of the travel ban. The show had been in the UK, and some very well-known people like Sting and Trudy Styler had to lobby on your behalf to get here.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? When you thought, my gosh, I might not get to go to the States and do this role.
Yeah. So it has different, look, to me as a human, if I knock the door of your house and you don't open to me, I'm not going to knock again in a way. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, please let me in. And there is another aspect of this story, which is the objective one. And I think that's where the collective responsibility is in. That if some people don't want me to come or don't want certain people to come to tell their story, we shouldn't just because of that stop trying to come, because there are other people who want to hear stories.
And that's the...
And that is the important bit.
To make sure as many people as can possible.
Yeah. And not only, it's like, that is, that it, that's what unites us mm-hmm. all. That we owe each other stories and share stories and share love. And I think it was hard to know that I might not come here. But just knowing, some people say to me, I'm sure you're aware of the success of the play. And I tell them, you know, I'm still overwhelmed by the success of humans when they come together, which is off stage. You just mentioned Trudy Staehler and, mm-hmm. and Sting and others like the mayor of New York. Yeah, it's just incredible. So, yeah, I'm still celebrating that, to be honest.
I'm going to say thank you so much, Amar Hajj, Ahmad, for joining us. The Jungle is at the St. Anne's Warehouse. It's so interesting. We got a comment that saying it's sold out, but hopefully the recent press will mean you're extending your opening. Fingers crossed, the more people that see this, the better. It sounds like a very meaningful production. That's from one of our listeners. So.
Thank you. And come to San Francisco because
that's it's going right.
to San Francisco.
At the Curran Theater.
Yes.
Road trip, everybody. We're going to San Francisco. Amar Hajj. Ahmad, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Jungle
Allison.
Is at St. Anne's Warehouse. You're listening to All of It on WNYC.